At this time, I would like to introduce our speaker, Fran Oh from Hawaii.
Aloha, my name is Fran and I'm an addict. I'd like to ask a question before we begin. Is Tina here, Vita's daughter? She can come in. Okay. You heard my story last night. You know, it's kind of hard following Carmelita. But her and I lived the same kind of life. You know, I always try to make a joke out of it because I don't understand how it happened so quick to me. But I know at 14, I wanted to be a nun. At 16, I was pregnant with my first daughter. At 17, pregnant with my second. And at 18, doing time in the old women's house for prostitution. That road, I always wonder, how the hell do I go from being a nun to a hooker so quick? Then I lived the life we all have, and I ended up at CIW, good old state of California, because I didn't... See, I kept thinking, like most of us, the problem is where we lived. So I moved, but as a result, I had a police record in every state I moved to. And then finally, I ended up in this wonderful state of California, and I ended up in California Institution for Women. It wasn't quite as big as it is now. I even hear they have a pool, which surprised the hell out of me. But we're going back an awful lot of years. And prisons were different. And I think I have a lot of gratitude for that, though. And back there, NA was a baby here in California. But every once in a while, they would have these panels in prison. And they'd have somebody from all different kind of agencies come in, and they'd all be on a panel, and you could ask questions. And somebody from NA came into that prison in the 60s. And I remember hearing it, and I walked out of that prison November 10th, 1966. And every time I left jail, I always said, never again. And I really believed it every time I left jail. And the miracle happened this time. It was never again. I know there's a lot of people here who have my tapes. There's a lot of people here from Monterey. And I always get uptight that they have to hear the same story again. But you know what? There's a whole lot of people who never heard it. So here we go. I need to tell you my early recovery. I really need to do that because you need to learn from it. You need to realize who's walking through the door, and we need to have a little compassion for the newcomers. There was no NA on the East Coast. And I was floundering. I knew I wanted to make it, and I couldn't. And I found an organization of ex-convicts. And I thought, okay, at least that's somebody I can relate to. And I showed up, and it was all guys. And that was okay. I needed to feel safe. And finally, this other woman came along, and she was working in the office. And I came into work one day, and she said, I can't stand you another minute. Put your coat on. We're going to a meeting. Now, I didn't have any idea where she was taking me. But you know, I must have been ready because I didn't even ask. I just went. And she took me to the other fellowship. Now, I had a lot of denial about being an addict. I always thought it was my behavior that got me where I was. But I didn't connect it to any of my drug use. And if I had denial about being an addict, I was worse about being an alcoholic because it wasn't my thing. So I went into this meeting, and she kept saying to me, you have to come back. You have to keep coming back. And I would go, and I'd hear all these people talking about these steps. And I'd say, what are the steps? And she said, never mind. Leave them alone. And And then I'd go to a step meeting and I'd hear it and I'd say, well, that's what I want, you know? I want what those people are talking about. And I'd say to her, how come we're not doing steps? And she'd say, you're too sick. And you want to know something? I didn't know I was sick. When I was at CIW, I wasn't allowed to be put out in population. I was in the psychiatric treatment unit. And I don't know why I thought I ended up there, but I really didn't connect to how crazy I really was. But she knew. And she'd say to me, just learn how to go to a meeting and don't pick up. That's all I want you to learn. And I had about 9 months clean, and it was springtime, and I pulled up at a meeting in a Cadillac. And I parked the car, and she's standing there looking at me, and she said, where'd you get the Cadillac? And I said, it's my boss's car. And she said, he gives you a Cadillac to come to a meeting? And I said, he's a trick. And she's looking at me, and she says, what do you mean he's a trick? I said, he's a John. She said, Fran, you can't be doing that in here. And I said, okay. When I had about 15 months clean, by the way, I wasn't allowed to celebrate the anniversary. I have a lot of gratitude for those meetings, but I wasn't wanted there. I wasn't allowed to go to closed meetings, and I couldn't share if I was going to talk about drugs. It was really old, old days, and I was definitely not allowed to celebrate that year. And my first 3 years of recovery, my kids got me a little cake. So when I had about 15 years clean, I was outside and she came out to talk to me and she said, Fran, some of the women just came to me, they're a little concerned. I says, about what? She said, they said when you went outside in the break to have a cigarette, you opened up your pocketbook and you had a pistol. And I said, yeah. And she said, what's the pistol for? I said, the robberies. She told me I couldn't do that anymore either. I don't think I knew what the hell you did in here. But you have to realize what I heard. When I came in, they said to me, all you have to do is don't pick up and go to a meeting. And I did exactly what you told me to do. Nobody told me about the rest. And I think there's a piece of me that will always, always be grateful for that. Because if I knew what was coming down the pike, I would have been out the goddamn door. You know, when you hear people in the meeting say that their worst day in recovery is still better than out there, that wasn't true for me. I liked not feeling the fucking pain you've given me in recovery. I had no idea the road I was about to embark on. And the road became painful, and a lot of that pain I caused myself. Because you know all those suggestions they tried to tell you? They weren't for me, and you didn't understand that. When they said, stay with the women, not me. I didn't like the women. So I wasn't staying with them. When I had 5 years clean, this is when I was getting well, I married a guy just out of prison who had just killed 3 people. That marriage lasted about 60 days because he was back out there banging. And that was probably the best screw up I ever did in my recovery, because that one took me into so much pain that I began to go to another fellowship for families. And a whole world started to change for me. Because you see, I was allowed to share there. They didn't care that I'd been in prison. They didn't care that I used drugs. And I was finally able to talk to some people about what the hell was going on in my life. And I have a lot of gratitude for that program. So there's a lot of people that helped. Finally, my very best friend, I want to say she had a slip. She had a goddamn landslide, man. We were a whole bunch of old-time dope fiends, and years later, this dizzy bitch picks up crack. And I still to this day have no understanding how you go from that one drug to that other one. And crack took her in the matter of months where heroin couldn't take her in years. And I watched it happening, and I was at a meeting and I was talking about it, and this guy raised his hand to share, and I took one look at his hands. And I said, oh, I got company. He had the mitt. And I said, okay, there's a heroin addict. It's getting a little bit better in here. And I went up to talk to him, and he said, you know, did you ever hear of NA? And I said, yeah, years ago, out in California. And he goes, well, they're here. I said, where are they? He goes, I don't know, I think they're underground. And we went on a hunt, and there was three meetings in New York at that time. And that was my history, because there was only the three meetings. The same exact people went to those three meetings. One was in the Bronx, one was in Manhattan, and one was in Queens. And you just showed up. If you had clean time and it was your anniversary, and maybe now there's five meetings, you were expected to go to all five meetings that week to speak, because they needed to see somebody was clean. There wasn't a lot of people. To say we were totally out of our minds is putting it mildly. I look back at the first New York region, and the only way I can describe what happened back there, five of the most powerful personalities that I will ever come across sat on the region. And if there was only one of us without the other four, NA would have been destroyed in New York. But all of us were so powerful, we wouldn't let the other four get away with anything. The fighting, the screaming, the insanity was beyond anything. But you started to watch it grow, and I'll tell you what became a little sad. People started to stay in their own backyards for the meetings, and we weren't all meeting anymore in these three meetings, and we started to miss each other. And I think once we started to part, we figured out we really loved each other. We just couldn't do it on that region. And NA opened up a world for me. It opened up steps that I never understood. And I'm not going to go through all the steps. I usually do. There's only a few, but one, and the most important one, nothing was right in my life. I had been working at this for so long, and I was in and out of relationships, I was in and out of marriages, I was a disaster as a mother. I sucked as a mother when they were young because I was using and I never took care of them, and I'd walk out and leave them anyplace. And then I sucked as a mother in recovery because I was running to meetings every night and gave a shit less that they were home by themselves. So first they lost me to drug addiction, and then they lost me to recovery. And I didn't know how to tell anybody that I really didn't want these kids, only because I didn't know what to do with them. I did not know how to be a mother, and I think we got this crazy idea that because a baby passes out between your legs, you have this thing that you know what to do, and you don't know what to do. And I was kind of lost. And I kept saying, I'm working so hard and my life is miserable. Now, some people work from the inside out, that didn't work for me. If you looked at my outside, boy, did I have it together. The kids were home with me, forget that I wasn't taking care of them. I had an apartment, I had the furniture, I had a car, and I had a job. and I looked like I had made it, and inside I was one miserable bitch. And the one thing that started to make sense for me when I came into NA is our first step was so different to anything I had seen. I had seen powerless over alcohol. We had, oh God, we had everything in New York. We had powerless over pills. We had powerless over cocaine. I never knew if that meant you could use heroin or not. You were just powerless over cocaine. But they had a first step for everything. And all of a sudden, somebody was saying to me, you're powerless over your addiction. And my addiction, my addiction was so much more than drugs. Drugs were probably the easiest thing I put down, because it meant total abstinence. I was addicted to relationships, to people pleasing. I smoked 2 packs of cigarettes a day. To this day, I must drink 20 cups of tea a day. I can abuse the shit out of anything that can be abused. And then I got in touch with, you know, I hear a lot of people say they picked up drugs and this is who I became. And it didn't happen to me. I was a liar, a thief, and a cheat before I ever picked up the first drug. So there was a whole bunch of shit I had to deal with. So just putting it down didn't make it all better for me. And the work kind of began. And I would go through the steps okay until I got, and this was really a good one for me, it's when I started to come to peace with myself. When I got to talking and looking at character defects, I had a real hard time with the higher power, all right? God was out of the question. I had 11 years of Catholic school, they cured that. And I couldn't get into all the other stuff they were telling me. And what I did is I renamed God, and I called him Harry, and that was fine. Harry and I worked. But when I got to the defects that I thought I couldn't wait to get rid of, I got frozen. And I couldn't get through it. And it took me, and I'm sorry it took me as long as it did, before I realized that what society and people in the program were calling my character defects, they were the best friends I ever had. They kept me alive on those goddamn streets where I should have been dead. They kept me alive in a penitentiary, how I don't know how I didn't get killed there. They were my saving grace for a lot of years. They weren't my enemy. And what worked for me was I needed to befriend what people called my character defects, and I had to realize that they kept me alive, but I was heading into a new life, and I needed to learn how to say goodbye to them and thank them. I began being asked to speak at conventions. Now you have to realize, in those days, there was no money. And I have a lot of, I was telling somebody online, I have a lot of gratitude for the days I came up in. I was the treasurer and the opening person at Freedom One in New York. And the first thing I remember is you have to realize we had no structure. There's no corporation, there's none of that shit, all right? There's no structure. We get this hotel and I'm the old person, not in time, but in age. I go to this hotel and I sign a personal note for $60,000 to be paid on such and such a date, and we just thought, that's okay. So asshole goes and signs my life away. And we weren't making money. We weren't going to be able to pay the bill. We actually passed the basket at the banquet that night. And someone even accused me, they said, how'd you know we couldn't make the bill? I said, my fucking name is on it. I know every cent that's coming through this door. And we paid that bill Saturday night at midnight. But you know what was great about those days? It was probably the only convention in New York that didn't have a scandal about stealing money because we didn't have any. So I'm glad that that's when I came up, that there wasn't access to all this stuff. The other thing that happened at that convention, for me and for a lot of people, was I was going to be open up the first meeting, and this real young, cute thing came up to me, this young lady, and she hands me this paper. And she said, "Will you please read this?" So I'm reading it, and it's about the language. We're new, right? We're coming up. And it was about using NA language, and it was kind of fitting a little nasty. And I took the paper, and I ripped it up in little pieces, and I held her hand out, and I put it in her hand, and I closed it. I said, "Now, honey, let me tell you something. I believe in NA with all my heart, and I believe we should have our own language, and I believe in recovery, and I believe in all of that. But God damn it, I've had 15 years of using a word, and you're going to have to be a little patient while I make this transition. Don't dare tell me." And you know what ended up? When I opened up the meeting that night, before I walked out, I looked up and I said, "Harry, whatever you do, don't let it come out of my mouth tonight." And I worked hard at it. And NA language is what I use today. And I've used it for years. But it's a learning, and it's being a power of example. We got people coming in here who are in treatment houses that go to both fellowships. They don't know what to say, and they don't know what to do. And it's always, I will be who I am. And I was really amazed when I finally got asked to speak at a world convention, because the world was a little pissed off at me. They used to say to me that they can't sell my tapes because of what I say. And I said, "Okay, do I make money on my tapes?" And they said, "No." I said, "So why do I give a shit if you sell them or not?" And what they were pissed off at is because my belief is it's my example that's going to pull you, not what I'm going to yell at you for. And one of the things I would always say, and I still say to this day, I choose to go to one fellowship. I choose NA, and I choose to be an addict in recovery. That's my choice. If you have found a way to stay clean, I don't care what fellowship it is. I don't care if you go to three fellowships. It's about staying clean, and you do what the hell you need to do that. And it's real simple for me. If you want what I got, you got to walk through the doors of NA. I don't go anyplace else, you know? But I had a sponsor. And when she had 24 years clean, she went out. And I had 18 years at that time, and I remember how angry I got. Forget that the poor bitch could die. I was angry that I got left. So I went without a sponsor for a while. And my kids were growing up. My one daughter picked up. She became an addict the minute she picked up. And we went through a war for 2 years because I couldn't control my addiction, so let's control hers. And finally, when I was in enough pain, I went back to that fellowship for families. And one more time, they saved my ass. And her and I came really to peace with each other. I've had someone say to me that we had a relationship by the time she was 21 that most people would give their right arm for. It was really okay. And she came up to my house one night, and she was a little high, you know, wasn't easy to hide with her. And we started talking, and I'd waited all those years to do an amends, and I thought, this is it. And I was finally able to say to her that I was really sorry for everything that ever happened. And that I, God damn it, I wish I could have turned that clock back. But I couldn't. And that I knew the damage I had done. And she told me she felt luckier than other people that if she decided to get clean, she knew where to go. And she left the house, and 24 hours later, I got the phone call that she was dead of an overdose. And you know, that night from that phone call, I can remember looking up and saying, thank you for last night. And one of the things I've learned, that things will always happen exactly when they're supposed to for my life. All I gotta do is get the fuck out of the way. And it did happen, time after time after time. The 12th step talks about a spiritual awakening, and Carmelita talked about wanting to change things in that book. If I had a choice of changing anything, I don't know if I'd call it a spiritual awakening. Maybe on your deathbed you have one, you know? But I've had spiritual experiences over and over, and the way I describe them, and God damn it, they don't last. I wish they did. All of a sudden, you'll be someplace, and there's a feeling in here happens, and you know you're exactly where you're supposed to be at the exact time you're supposed to be there, and this feeling happens, and that's it. That's the spiritual, and it's such a wonderful feeling for a couple of days. And then you're back to being the lunatic that you normally are. And I've had a lot of them. Quebec, East Coast Convention, time after time. I got a phone call when one of my sponsees had just found out she had AIDS. And I hung up the phone, and I was crying, and the phone rang. And this guy on the phone says, hi, I'm an addict from Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and we want you to come speak at a meeting. And I busted out laughing because I didn't know there was such a place. I knew we had Oshkosh jeans. And I said to him, this call was perfect. So off I go to Oshkosh, and I still kid about this, I didn't know who the hell was shooting dope in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. But I was going to some workshops during the day, and there was one on grief. And I got there, and there was this young boy. I used to say young kid, and he got his feelings hurt. There was a young man, and his name was Mark. And he got up to share, and he was clean all of 90 days. And he was talking about grief he's had in recovery. He was given up for adoption as a child. And he went on the search for his mom, and by the time he found out where she was, she had died 10 years before. And he said he got left with, why didn't she love me? And why didn't she want me? And what was wrong with me? So I left the meeting, and I was the speaker that night, and I was sitting up there in a thing like this, and I'm looking through the door, and everyone says, who are you looking for? You don't know anyone here. And finally, I spotted him coming in. And I went down to the table where he was sitting, and I went up behind him, and I said, Mark, tonight is for you. And he thought I was a lunatic. He had no idea who I was. And when I spoke, I did my steps, and I started talking about things I did in recovery. And one of the things I did is I'd given a daughter up for adoption. And in my recovery, I went and signed up at a place where if you're the birth parent, and they can only find you if they do the search. But I signed up because I felt she had a right to her roots, to her heritage, and she had a right to know that I gave birth to her in prison, and I had already destroyed two kids and didn't want to destroy the next one, and I finally loved a human being enough to give them a chance at life. And I looked down, and Mark was sitting there crying, and we spent a lot of time together that weekend. And when I left, he said to me, you'll never know what you've done for my recovery. It never dawned on me she might have loved me and might have cared. And I looked at Mark and said, you don't know what you've done for mine, because now I know why I'm in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. I got a phone call from Phoenix, Arizona. Would I come speak? And I was all set to go, and I was in therapy at that time, and I was in school. I went to graduate school. And I had one of these aggressive therapists. And I said to her, gee, I'm going to go to Phoenix. She goes, no, you're not. I said, why not? She says, that's the weekend of your graduation. And you're going to walk up there on that stage, and you're going to get that diploma you just earned, and you're not going to run from it, and Arizona can wait. So I got up on the stage, and I got my diploma and got my master's degree. And it was wonderful. The next year, I got a phone call from Arizona. Would you come to Tucson? I said, you got it. And off I went. And at that convention in Tucson, I met my daughter, who I gave up for adoption. Her and her daughter were there. And I think her daughter was about 8 then. And we kept a relationship going. Something had just changed again. And it always happens at those goddamn conventions. There was a whole lot more that happened. And finally along the way, I had to get another sponsor. This one's a pitch. You have to understand, we came from a hard time. We came from being told exactly what Carmelita said to you last night. Shut the fuck up is what you were told when you walk into a meeting. I used to meet my sponsor at a meeting. First, I'd call her. I got to talk to you. Nah, see you at a meeting. I got to talk to you now. Nope, see you at a meeting. And I'd get to the meeting. I'd say, I got to talk to you. Go make the coffee. I said, but I have to talk. Go make the coffee. And then you'd sit through the meeting, and when it was over, she'd say, so you feel better now, right? And her whole thing was, you take your shit to a meeting. Stop bothering her. And then when I'd get mad, she'd tell me, scrub the coffee pot. You feel, bang the coffee pot instead of being mad at me. And I would be banging that goddamn coffee pot. But you were really told what to do and how to do it. And I had a thing one time. I was really, really hard on my sponsees. Really. The early days, I don't know how they handled. I really don't. But Carmen, who had AIDS, was up at my house spending a weekend because she was real sick. And one of my new sponsees came in. And it was summertime, and she had these shorts cut way up her ass. She had this top hanging way down. I don't say nothing. And while we're talking, Carmen says to her, I used to be like you. So this woman says, what do you mean by that? She says, when I first came around, all I knew how to do was be a body. She says, it took a long time before I became a person. And it went right over Lori's head. So when Lori left, Carmen looks at me and she goes, what the hell's happened to you? You would have killed us if we ever walked out like that. And I said, I guess I've just mellowed. I think there's another way. And she said, Fran, I wouldn't have changed if you weren't there screaming at me to do it. And then she reminded me of the night we were all going to a dance, and one of my sponsees had just left her husband. So she was going out there, and she showed up at my house. We're all gonna leave together. And I said to her, where do you think you're going? She says, to the dance. I said, not dressed like that with me. I said, go home and change. And that's the way it was back then. And maybe it needed to change. We needed to be a little more mellow. And I got myself a new sponsor. And she was about as mellow as they could be. The amazing thing about her and I is we were in that prison 32 years ago together. So the thought that we were both still alive was a fucking miracle. And what I realized is that she came along in my life at exactly the right time, because I had new stuff to learn. I'd already learned about how to stay clean, and I'd already learned about the steps. And one of the most wonderful things she ever gave me was she taught me how to be a grandma. And she stayed there for a while because that was safe for me. And before I knew it, I'd become a terrific grandmother. And when my daughter died, I thought there was a hole here that was never, ever going to get replaced. And all of a sudden, to have a granddaughter saying to you, "Hi, Grandma, I love you," it was filled. And I realized that hole was now filled, and that what my higher power gave me was a chance to do this again. You fucked it up the first time. Come on, kiddo, we're going second time around, you know? And I don't know a whole lot of people who get a second chance at this shit. But I was given one. And so many things happened in those years between her and I. And one was, I learned acceptance of other people like I had never learned it before. And some of it came from Carmen. When she had AIDS and she was very, very sick, I knew I wanted her to have the best care she could have. And we'd fight all the time because she wouldn't go to the floor I wanted her on in the hospital, and she wouldn't go to the doctor I wanted her to go to. And there was this, and one time she stopped talking to me for 2 months. And then when she called me up, she said, "I love you and I miss you, but you've got to stop." And after I stopped, I mean, one dumb example was she was in with pneumonia one time, and there was the AIDS floors in New York at that time, and she couldn't get a bed up there. And this time, they came to interview, and I said, "Thank God she's going to get the help she needs." And she turned them down. So I would get off, I wouldn't fight with her no more. I'd tell her somebody was ringing my doorbell, and I'd hang up. And what I realized was, on the AIDS floor, she had AIDS. On the medical floor, she had pneumonia. And at that time in her life, she needed to have pneumonia. And I had to learn how to leave that alone and let people be wherever they were. And it was amazing to try to teach my daughter that. My granddaughter is from Korea, and she's Asian. And my life. So she enters the school system in New York, and my daughter calls me up one time and she says, "Mom, you gotta help on this one." I said, "What?" She thinks she's black. I said, "Okay, put her on the phone." So she gets on the phone, and I go through this whole heritage thing. I said, "Asians aren't yellow." That was the last one. I said, "White people aren't really white. Black people aren't black." So I'm going to, I said, "Asians aren't, you're not yellow." She goes, "I know I'm not, I'm black." And what was happening is she was the only Asian in her school. And there were black kids and white kids. Now they already told her she wasn't white. So there was only one other place she was. So I got my daughter back on and I said, "So she's black for a while, leave her alone. She'll figure it out." Just letting somebody be, you know? And it's really believing that we do the best we can. Well, about, I loved going to conventions. I loved the energy. I loved the people. I used to hear other speakers say how painful sometimes it was to get up here and speak, and they just did it. Me, I got off on it. I loved the energy of that room. And 2 years ago, in June, I was sitting at a restaurant with Mary, and I went to order, and I couldn't speak. And my head was going a mile a minute, but it was gone. And as calm as could be, she looked at me and she said, "Do we need to go to a hospital?" And as calm as I could be, I shook my head, "Yep," and off we went. And I'd had a stroke. Now, for anyone to know how much my mouth runs, to ever be able to not speak was horrible. So I was in the hospital for a while, and I came home, and I thought, okay, we have NA on the internet now. I'm not allowed to leave the house. I can't be around people, but I'll get on the computer. So there I sat, the same part of your brain that makes this work, makes the words work. And I typed my first sentence and looked at it and didn't know what the hell it just said. So I couldn't go to meetings there. I started to heal, and I think I did about 2 other conventions after that. But it wasn't fun anymore. It was so much work. The energy was gone. I couldn't travel. So I went to Kauai and I said, this is it. I can't do this anymore. I'm too ill. And I guess Hawaii's the worst for me because, see, I tell people there, nighttime meetings, it's when I'm the worst. I go down and my speech gets all fucked up and I have to take naps every day. And I say to people at the meetings, do me a favor at night, don't come over talking to me. And they didn't hear me. And one of the things Mary always said to me is, if you had a stroke that had a physical disability, they'd see it. But your disability is brain damage and people can't see that. So what I learned to do is I go to a meeting 5 minutes late and I leave 5 minutes early, and that way nobody talks to me. And I'm very happy with that. People have stopped calling. I tell people you can't call after 6 o'clock at night. I'm not going to talk to you. I started to make boundaries for myself. I had a sponsor who helped me do that because she was having trouble. And we used to call up and laugh about how old we're getting. And a couple of months ago, she called me up. So we're talking, and I said, so Vita, what the hell did you call me for? She says, well, I got to tell you something. I said, what? She says, Southern Cal asked me to call you. I said, don't start. I'm not coming. I said, Vita, I can't do this anymore. She says, I've said that too. But there's times you're going to feel better and you're going to do it again. That was a year ago. I said, no, I can't do it. And on the phone, she says to me, Fran, you have to do this one. You and I are getting old and we're getting sick. And this is the last time we're going to see each other. I came to Southern California and I got up at that podium making fun of her saying that to me. I says, look how the bitch manipulated me in, telling us she's going to die. And she died. And I have such goddamn gratitude that I came back to speak and spend that weekend with her. I think the thing I loved the most about having her for a sponsor was it was somebody else saying they were a lousy mother and being okay with it, and somebody else being able to share what they did to their kids and be okay with it. Last night, Carmelita tried to tell you, we blew it. Even in early recovery, we blew it with our kids. And you guys need to learn from that. There's a man that was real, real important in my life. I met him when I was a hooker out in the streets. I met him at Washington, D.C., in an NA World Convention. He was a priest. And he used to always say, there's a special place down in here. And his dream was to get addicts to be able to feel that. And that's the feeling I get when things happen to me at a convention. When Anthony called me about Vita being in the hospital, he said to me, don't worry, miracles can happen. I didn't want a miracle for her. I wanted to wish her a safe journey. And Carmelita and I were talking about it last night. I think being sick and having a stroke and coming that close to death helped. But Christmas time, I had a bunch of people at my house, and everybody thinks I work too much. And I do. And somebody said to me, keep it up, keep it up. Wanting to yell at me, she said, so are you ready to die? I said, absolutely. And everybody got dead quiet. And you know the most, I wish I could tell you how peaceful that is, to know that I've done everything I want to do, I've lived a life I wanted to live, and if it ended tomorrow, it's okay, I got nothing to hold on to anymore. Somebody wrote something, and it was about thinking of Vita, and it's about thinking of everybody that was standing up here last night with time. I just want to read it. Only those are fit to live who do not fear to die, and none are fit to die who have shrunk from the joy of life and the duty of life. Both life and death are parts of the same great adventure. And I really did wish Vita a safe trip, and that's the best I could wish for her. You know, a lot of the themes here this weekend, I went to a couple of workshops, and it was about history. There was a lot of history going on here. History will change. You got your old timers in, and as they leave, new blood's going to step up, and new blood, and you're going to make the same stupid ass mistakes we made. You don't learn from shit. Every convention committee will kill each other. But I really thought about what this convention meant for me. And I'm going to do something a little unusual. There's a couple of people that I want to come up. I know the wheelchair can't come through, but she's there. But there's a couple of people I want to come up here. Just stand down here, if you will. Bean, where are you? Is he here? Billy? See, they snuck out. That's what they get. Carmelita. Bob, get up here. Right here. Right here. There's Billy. Ricardo, are you in here? Where's Ricardo? Terry, where are you? Terry hates this shit. She don't want to be out in the public. Where's Terry? I know she's here. I saw her. Here with 25 years or more. Please come up. Where's Pat? Huh? Where's Pat? Pat, is Pat and Steve here? Where's Pat? Where's Steve? There's Pat. Where's Steve? He's not here. For all of you, for your 30 days that have come in, and for the rest of you, this is your history. And I need to tell you, we're getting old, goddammit. You better listen while we're here. Thank you, and this is my spiritual group. Thank all of you.